the city, back of my neck getting dirty and gritty. Welcome to the June episode of AZMcast. June in Tucson means beginnings and it means endings. It's the beginning of summer, which means you have to get up at 5 a.m. if you want to go outside. It means you'll park a half a mile away from your destination if it means your car will be in the shade. And it means people will mount up on motorized vehicles and fling them into each other. That's right, June is head injury season. So we clipped a lecture from Dr. Bilal Joseph with our trauma team about updates in traumatic brain injury. And it is fantastic to see some of the things that we are not doing in TBI anymore. June also means the end of another era as we say goodbye to another crop of stellar emergency medicine residents and two fantastic emergency medicine pediatric residents. They are going on to fame and fortune and a lot of uncertainty as they start the practice on their own, so we've brought back Dr. Casey Solemn, one of our recent graduates, to share his opinion of his first year out. We also have some excellent parting words from Dr. Peter Rosen, capped off with the Brian Drummond peer review. So put on some sunscreen, crank up the AC, and let's get to some summertime learning. Do you ever just sit back and wonder why is the sky blue? Why are we here? Why are we admitting this person with a pixel of blood on their head CT? Why does it seem like everyone who starts an anticoagulant immediately falls down a flight of stairs? I'm not kidding. The last shift, I swear every person in Tucson who owned a car got off work early and crashed it into each other. Well, Bilal Joseph and our trauma team asked themselves the same questions and have put together a pretty impressive body of evidence to answer some of the questions regarding TBI. Dr. Joseph spoke at one of our university resident conferences a while back and discussed some of the updates that they've found. Specifically, who needs a repeat head CT? Who needs neurosurgery consultation? Who needs to go to the ICU, and who can just be observed over a course of a few hours and not even be admitted? Which anticoagulant should I be worried about, and how do I reverse them if I need to? Now, some of this evidence is still not quite ready for prime time, but some of it is being implemented already. So throughout this talk, Dr. Joseph references multiple graphs, multiple charts, which you can't see because you're listening to an audio podcast. What that means is that you need to look at the reference provided and actually read these articles on your own so that you can get a good idea of what they say and whether or not you agree with the conclusion. This is a pretty literature-heavy talk, so get your screenshot fingers ready for TBI updates.
You must learn!
We're going to spend about an hour to just kind of go over kind of how we've changed the way we approach traumatic brain injury. And some of the evidence to why we've done it and what it's done. So we looked at this paper looking at trends in trauma injury and death, and the bottom x-axis is years in age. And you can see that in the blue is in the census from 2000, and the red is the census from 2010. And you can see that trends in death are moving up and to the right for trauma. And that's very concerning. Here's your elderly, this is your baby boomers, and then again, the young people, we know this. These three peaks now are getting higher and pushed over more. And we think this is all because of the baby boomers. And this is gonna impact the way we manage patients. And when you look at death from all, you know, the major causes of death, whether it be cancer, heart disease, or trauma death, you know, we do really well in heart disease, we're doing really well in cancer, everything to the left of the line is actually is improved, not death, and then everything to the right, you can see, again, you see these three peaks, and this is by age, trauma death is increasing, and so you guys are in the front line of this, so that's a big problem. And then we look at what, you know, the leading cause of trauma death, you know, TBI is the leading cause, there's no doubt. And, you know, if you look at that, you know, this is MS versus spinal cord, HIV, AIDS, breast cancer, and then TBI injuries, the burden of traumatic brain injury continues to grow. And if you look at TBI admissions, again, the EDs are just blowing up with this. And then you think about population changes. By 2000, you know, every day 10,000 patients are becoming over the age of 65, every single day. And that's the baby boomers turning into that age group. And a lot more antiplatelet therapy. And so how is this impacting what we do? And so you sit here and you start thinking about all this. You know, how are we managing? And, you know, a lot of what we do, and for the residents, I really think, always ask why. Always challenge the norm. That's the best way you can do research, really. The same questions that, you know, we do things because that's how we taught how to do them. And I really, you know, most of the research I've ever done is always from when I was a resident fellow to now. It's just, you know, someone will say, that's how we do it. And I'm like, okay, well, let's just see what the data has or shows. And that's kind of what you'll see here. So the few things we're going to talk about are like the routine repeat head CT, and then the acute treatment plan, the antiplatelet therapy, coagulation or coagulopathy. All of this will relate to you, you know, even when you manage these patients from the ED to the point they get to the ICU. And so we're going to talk about the role of, you know, routine repeat head CTs. And, you know, the current treatment plan, the patient comes in, they get scanned, they are found to have a bleed on CT, and then that results in a neurosurgical consultation and then a repeat head CT. And I would say, you know, sometimes we do things here and we don't always consult neurosurgery anymore because with the brain injury guidelines, but the reality is in about 90% of the country, that's what they do. And, you know, then the patient gets admitted and then they get another repeat and then another repeat, and you guys have seen it all. You all have seen this. And so, you know, and first of all, use of head CT is going up across all age groups, and we know that this has some risks of radiation exposure and increased hospital costs. This is no bueno for any of the patients. When we talk about the reason to get the initial head CT, there's great evidence on, you know, there's different protocols and different rules why we get the initial head CT. But when we talk about the repeat head CT, really, it's still, you know, the literature out there is still very divergent. And if you ask any neurosurgeon, of course, repeat in 6 hours, repeat in 12 hours. Some, I have friends, they have to repeat 6, 12, and 24 hours. It's kind of crazy, but that's the reality. And so when you look at the trauma literature as, you know, should you repeat, should you not repeat, it was kind of divided. And, you know, yes, you know, but the way most of these studies are done, I think methodology is very important. And what we did is we looked at 1,300 of patients here, our cases. And when you look, you know, we divide them into mild, moderate, and severe TBI. And this was just initially just in mild TBI. This basically shows, you know, improvement for findings on the repeat head CT. And this is just a small sub-analysis. But my whole point was, when you look at mild TBI, you know, the number of changes, 15 had no changes. Improvement was like 80%. Some people had progression, but no interventions, no EVDs. Even in moderate TBI, it was the same thing. And then when you get to severe TBI, you had some progression, which required intervention. And so what we did is we took 1,300 of these scans and we followed them. And we said, okay, we're going to split the patients now. And the patients that we could examine and follow a neurological decline on, change in pupils, change in focal neurological deficits, any type of neurological change, an exam, you know, they get the Q1-hour neuro checks. And of the 960 patients who had a GCS greater than 8, which means they were examinable, when, you know, the neurological exam itself had 100% sensitivity. And its specificity was 98% and had a negative predictive value of 100%. That means if you were able to examine the, no one got an intervention, no matter what the CT showed, no matter what the repeat head CT showed, no one got an intervention without a change in their neuro exam. And that's important because we don't treat the CT, right? You may see a little progression, but you don't change, you don't. And so really, we don't, when we're, you know, we've taken control of this to a certain extent. Now, don't get me wrong, the neurosurgeons in severe TBI and all of the work that we've done, I'll be honest with you, I talk to our neurosurgeons, I'm in collaboration with them because that's, you know, that's their subspecialty. But in examinable patients with a GCS greater than 8, a normal neurological exam where you can examine them and there's no change in neurological exam, there's no indication for a repeat head CT. And that changes a lot. And the other thing important, these are not an anticoagulated patient, so they're not on aspirin, they're not on Plavix, they're not on Coumadin, Pradexa, whatever else. So and that's kind of how we've kind of shifted a little bit.
In summary, a routine repeat head CT is not necessary for patients who are examinable, not anticoagulated, with a normal neuro exam, and a GCS greater than 8. This is currently being practiced at Banner University Medical Center in Tucson.
And so that was the first thing we started doing. I'm like, well, maybe we need to take this a little further. So you know that our CT scanners are just phenomenal now, right? The 128, one, whatever number they're at now with the cuts. And there's improvement in the technology. And so now we're picking up things we would have never seen before. And what is the clinical significance of the subarachnoid WIM that you see on one cut? I mean, how many patients have we had transferred here that we've discharged from the ED? And so, again, the majority of traumatic brain injury, we said it's a big burden, but the majority of it is mild. And and a lot of times when you guys are in the ICU, you see neurosurgery resident come in, they'll order a repeat scan, Q1-hour neuro checks, and the next morning, what do? A sign off. That's right, they sign off. And so it started bugging me. And so you start looking at the neurosurgical. It really was. And you look at the 90% of traumatic brain injury is non-operative. And it's usually managed by the critical care team. And if you know, when they surveyed neurosurgeons and asked them, that most of them feel they don't want to deal with trauma, nor do they feel like they're in charge of the trauma patient unless it's operative. And if you look at the burden of number of neurosurgeons is actually decreasing with the population, and the demand is way up. And we're fortunate we have a neurosurgeon. I mean, you go to some. We did this to kind of say, okay, maybe in a level one trauma center, we're very fortunate we have neurosurgeons that can come and go. But the reality is, across the country, this is not so lucky. And so the idea of not consulting neurosurgery for mild injury has been out there. And we're talking more concussion, maybe some subarachnoid. It's been since 1996, there's been paper here, paper there. But there was no definitive guidelines. And so what we set out to do, we took 3,800 traumatic brain injury patients, and we basically categorize them by physical exam, initial CT findings, the size of bleed, the type of bleed, the skull fracture, and we developed these guidelines. And what we said was, you know, big one, big two, big three. And it's basically neurological exam, and we have cards for this we can pass out, and I think it's hung up down in the ED. Intoxication, Coumadin, aspirin, Motrin, Plavix, or any anticoagulation, skull fracture, and then the type of bleed. You know, what should we do? So we went, and I could tell you, I fought with the neurosurgeons so hard on this. I got, even the manuscript we got submitted, I mean, people were like in flames. No way, how can you not call us, da da da. I said, let's just look what it shows. And they were even, in the big one initially was actually 5 millimeters. And they made me push it down, they wanted 3. And I was like, no, we'll go to 4. How about somewhere in the middle? And so, I mean, can you take a piece of pen, imagine in your mind drawing 4 millimeter bleed. Like, really think about that. And a GCS 15 young kid who has, so if you are not anticoagulated, you don't have a skull fracture, and you have a bleed less than 4 millimeters, or a subarachnoid that's read as trace, no intraventricular hemorrhage, we say observe and discharge, no repeat head CT scan, and no neurosurgical consultation. And then big one is kind of easy. And then forget big two for a second. Big three, I mean, obviously, if they have an abnormal neurological exam, if they're intoxicated, you can't examine them. If they're on anticoagulation, if it's a displaced skull fracture, and if they have a bleed greater than 8 millimeters, you know what? Let's admit them to the ICU. Let's call neurosurgery. And a lot of these patients won't be examinable, so let's repeat their head scans. Because they are, you know, I mean, there's a lot of, these are the sickest patients. So that's easy too, right? That's what we've always done. The real forest area, if you want to call it that, or the area in the middle is big two. Normal neurological exam, but a bleed that's 5 to 7 millimeters, not on any anticoagulation, a non-displaced skull fracture, because there's papers that show when your skull fracture, if you have a skull fracture that's displaced versus non-displaced, completely different progression into worsening neurological exam. But basically we said, okay, these patients can go to admit to the hospital, even the ICU, no repeat head CT scan unless indicated by neurological exam, and no neurosurgical consultation. And so we took that, and then we said, we fought for a while, and then finally they agreed. Well, I said, you know what, change is hard, so let's just do it slow. So right now, the only thing we're implementing is big one, which is the less than 4 millimeter bleed. We can independently manage this. And so we said, okay, we're going to prospectively validate this. And that's what we did. We prospectively validated big one. And if you look at implementation of it, it started in 2011. This is our failure. Failure's in red. You can see the first 3 months, it was just violation after violation. Everybody was still consulting neurosurgery. Nobody was comfortable. Even my partners weren't comfortable with this. And then as you go forward, you can see how big one, this is all big one. Now we're pretty much at 100%. And I don't know if we're batting somewhere above 90 for sure. And for the consultation in neurosurgery. And so then you say, well, what does this mean? So, you know, big one, when no neurosurgery versus neurosurgery consultation in a propensity matched cohort, meaning we match them for everything. Look at this. Repeat head CTs, we 9% versus 51%. And these are 4 millimeter bleeds or less. progression on repeat head CT, same thing. Oops, sorry. You know, there was no difference. No surgical intervention, 0%. Hospital admission, from 74% to 56%. ICU admission, I mean, that's a huge deal, not sending every one of these head injuries to the ICU, especially when, like, the last few nights where you've been running around and it's been crazy busy. You got enough admissions. I mean, and then we looked at 30-day readmission. Okay, what about the patients once they get discharged from the hospital? No difference between the two groups. Actually, you know what the follow-up for all neurosurgical patients with head injury is? It's about 20%. We followed this. It's about 20% of the patients actually follow up with neurosurgery, with trauma, with a neurologist, or at all. And then if you look at 30-day ED visits, again, no difference between the group. And 30-day, meaning they came in and they needed a repeat head CT for some nausea, headache, whatever it may be. Again, there was no difference between the two groups. And then mortality, there was, again, it's such a small number, but there's no difference. And this, we matched for every component for these patients. And so we said, you know what? We can implement Big One, and we can also, you know, prospectively, we showed that it actually worked. And so what is a bigger picture for this whole big, you know, this is a Big One sub-analysis, basically just showing pre and post big, again, the number of repeat head CTs, the progression on, there was no difference in progression or surgical intervention, but look at the consultations, 87% to 8%. Hospitalizations, again, we have, this is kind of the same table, but this kind of shows that it's kind of changed. And what, so since we've started talking about big one, big two, big three, because sometimes we still run big two, we got a 35% compliance rate with big two, meaning people don't actually call neurosurgery. But if you look at overall what big has done, 400 patients pre-big, 390 patients post-big, again, 90% neurosurgical consultation prior to 71%. The number of repeat head scans, 92% to 66%. And again, there's no difference in progression, no difference in intervention, no difference in intervention based on the repeat scans. ICU days, ICU admission down from, 61 to 53%. And I know that doesn't matter as much when you're a resident and all this stuff, but this stuff makes a huge difference for hospital costs, patient costs. It's a big change. So this is kind of where we're headed. And then when you look at hospital costs per patient and thousands of dollars, you can see it's been trending down for head injury. If you look at hospital length of stay and ICU length of stay, again, same thing. The next bar is hospital, this is ICU. They're both kind of coming down. And then if you look at head CTs per patient, again, from 2.3 to 1.3 on average, head CTs per patient. And so that's kind of how the brain injury guidelines kind of have come into play. We are actually now we're going to do a multi-center trial, or not trial, a prospective analysis looking at multiple institutions. It's already been implemented, University of Florida, Jacksonville. There's two centers in Brazil that are already enrolled, but there's a bunch, the American Association of Surgery of Trauma has allowed this to be a multi-center prospective trial now to show this. So it may change the way we deal with this. And the next time you're working in a, if you end up working in a small facility somewhere that doesn't have neurosurgical coverage and you've got a small bleed, maybe that patient doesn't need to be transferred. You transfer helicopter ride from cells. Does anybody know how much that costs? It's about $24,000 per patient for a little bleed. Not because it's, cells just got their CT scan a year ago. So now they have a CT. But that's, so I think it's important as we move forward. So that's the brain injury guidelines. I think for now, when you're going to change the way we practice things, I really think you have to go slow. I really think you have to be safe. You know, if I tell you what I got from the neurosurgeons initially, there was this one patient 10 years ago who left the hospital with a small subdural who came back and died and big lawsuit. And I'm like, okay, one patient out of, maybe that one story. There's always that one story. So I would just say for now, maybe we'll get to that point. Do we need to consult? Maybe sending these people to neurologists who do the follow-up concussion and TBI stuff is the rest. There's a huge push in outpatient follow-up and where we're going with this. But for now, I would say have someone to have follow-up with.
Summary. Not all head bleeds need a neurosurgeon, and some can just be observed. However, all of them need follow-up once they leave the emergency department or the hospital. Consult the big guidelines for your next head bleed, as this is also being implemented at Banner University Medical Center in Tucson.
We're going to talk a little bit about antiplatelet therapy. We see this all the time. The need for, repeat head, repeat imaging. The first five papers written on this. It was Coumadin, aspirin, Motrin, and Plavix. And they used to combine all of those patients into one population. And then I know for you guys, one of the big questions is, okay, what if they come in and they have a negative head CT? Should we still admit them? Do they need to be followed? And I think it depends on the type of anticoagulation. So initially, all antiplatelets, they put them together. They'd have aspirin patients, Plavix patients, all in one group. And the first thing we did is we said, okay, we're going to just look at low-dose aspirin. People who come in who have head bleeds on their CT scan on only low-dose aspirin versus no aspirin at all. And when you looked at this group, there was no difference. Well, how does that help? What does that change? One, it changes the need for repeat imaging. Two, it changes the need for platelet transfusion, the time to go to surgery to get a cranny. And so when we looked at low-dose versus high-dose aspirin and no aspirin, so no aspirins here, low-dose aspirin and high-dose. You can see progression on repeat head CT. We use no aspirin as a reference. You know, there was no difference between no aspirin and low-dose, but high-dose aspirin had an increase of progression. High-dose aspirin had increased neurological decline on exam and also had increased intervention. So, you know, I know this may sound so like, oh, okay, so what? But it's now changed the way people think about this. No longer do you just say, are you taking aspirin? You're on baby aspirin or full? And even the neurosurgeons now kind of follow along with this too. And then when you talk about Plavix, I would just tell you, Plavix is the devil. I mean, I don't know how else to say it, but patients who are on Plavix, they have worsening progression, they have more intervention, and they have, you know, overall neurological decline. So if you have someone on Plavix, you know, because that's another thing, should we repeat head CT everybody on aspirin, Plavix, Coumadin? Yeah, if you're on Plavix, you know, everything I've ever looked at, every time we've tried to look at this, again, in a propensity match group, 1-to-1, we showed that, you know, Plavix patients progress more, need more intervention, and actually have more worse head CTs. So all antiplatelet therapy is not equal. Low-dose aspirin therapy don't need a routine repeat head CT. And basically, high-dose and Plavix aspirin, I would treat them the same. And then who do we transfuse? You know, because it's always been the standard, what? You're on antiplatelet, you got a head bleed, give them platelets, right? So simple. And we tried to look at this. It was really hard to look at. And we took patients prospectively. If you came in on full-dose aspirin, and we measured your platelet function on the Verify Now assay, is what the cardiologists and the radiologists use. We measured their platelet function using an assay. Of the 28 patients who came in, 6 came in with functioning platelets, and 22 came in with non-functioning platelets. Then we gave everybody platelets. We transfused everybody platelets, and we didn't make any clinical decisions based on this. And then we said, okay, well, now we're gonna check and see what happens to their platelet function after transfusing platelets. In the patients who had functioning platelets, you can see 4 went on to maintain functioning platelets, and 2 actually had non-functioning platelets after platelet transfusion. And the patients who had non-functioning platelets, 4 of them became functioning, and 18 remained non-functioning platelets after transfusion of platelets. All right, that's the standard, right? Transfuse them. And I'm not telling you platelets are bad. I think platelets are appropriate. But are we giving enough? Is one pack enough? Maybe we need to do 2 packs. Maybe we actually, I mean, TEG and platelet assays have completely revolutionized the way we resuscitate coagulation now. But that's another question that we're doing now. And so we've actually gone away from 1 pack. We do 2 packs now. And we're looking to see if that makes a difference. But even from a lab standpoint, 1 pack of platelets doesn't change your, and I mean, I get it's only 28 patients, but this is the only paper written about this subject. And you know why? Because I used to always say, how do I know 1 pack of platelets makes a difference? So now, no platelets for baby aspirin. Yes, platelets for full-dose aspirin and Plavix. But the real question is how much? And then, you know, this whole big thing of platelet count, right? How many times have you been in the ICU and nurses are like, oh, their platelet count's 92. It's got to be above 100. You got to give them platelets. And so I was like, what the heck are we talking about? Let me go look at this. And really, actually, they're onto something. We looked at patients who were on aspirin, full-dose aspirin or Plavix. And then we looked at platelet count by 25,000. And we wanted to see which platelet count gave us the highest incidence of worsening on repeat head CT. you know, with a good sensitivity and a good AUC, which is 0.8 is pretty good. It's not like, but less than 135,000 was the magic number, and you can see the odds ratio for progression on CT. So if you're on antiplatelet therapy and you have a head bleed, if your platelet counts are less than 135,000, you have a pretty good chance of worsening. And then when we did the same thing for neurosurgical intervention, the need for neurosurgical intervention, you know, if your platelet counts were less than 95,000, you know, your odds ratio was 34, but this is adjusting for GCS, head AIS, skull fractures, the type of bleed, subdural, epidural, progression, and look at this sensitivity in this AUC. So, you know, what do we take from that? So if your platelet count is less than 135,000 on antiplatelet therapy, you know, maybe that's what we need to push for. Maybe we need to push the transfused platelets to 135,000. So again, I think still more to come.
Summary, baby aspirins don't count, and these patients can be treated as non-anticoagulated. They don't need repeat head CTs, and they don't need platelet transfusions. A full-dose aspirin and Plavix, on the other hand, are the devil and may require more than just one unit of platelets for full reversal. This is not yet in play, but it seems that we're headed in this direction. So this is a great body of literature to be familiar with, because some of the things that will frustrate you when you do your sticky rotation or you do your trauma rotation in the near future may not frustrate you anymore because we'll have figured them out. So thanks again to Dr. Joseph for letting us use that talk.
Welcome to the real world.
This can't be.
Be what? Be real?
I can't go back, can I?
No. But if you could, would you really want to?
Many of you are graduating, but all of you are wishing you were graduating. You can ask me, you can ask Jared about life outside of residency, but we've only worked here, save for maybe a few months out of the academic womb, moonlighting. You can ask Drummond, but let's be honest, he's pretty far removed from his first year out as well, and he was probably bloodletting as an intern. Start thinking of a good comeback now, Brian. So we wanted to get the opinion from someone who is fresh out of residency and done with their first year. So we asked Dr. Casey Solemn, one of our university campus chiefs from last year, to come back and tell us about his first year. Now, Casey was a great resident. He was a good doctor, but you'd never know it based on the way he describes himself in this next segment. He's pretty hard on himself, but I think that the honesty factor is huge. And his stream of consciousness rant on being out there on your own for the first time is very eye-opening. For starters, describe your practice right now. Where do you practice? What kind of an ED is it?
So I cover four ERs right now, and they actually five. I work at a fifth hospital too. Four banner hospitals and one that is a little bit more of like a moonlighting thing that I wanted to work with my dad before he retired, and he works in a small single coverage ER in Payson, Arizona, where much of the time you're literally the only doctor in the hospital. And then that varies all the way up to Banner University Medical Center Phoenix, which is the old Good Samaritan, which has every subspecialist you want. I've got trauma surgeons 24/7. I've got everybody I need. I got an ICU that will take a patient within 5 minutes of the phone call. So they come in looking septic. I sometimes don't even have labs back, and they've gone upstairs. I'm not putting in lines. I'm not doing as much titrating of pressors or even starting the pressors. That all gets done upstairs. But I work then at three other hospitals in between. Each of those is a little bit more of a community hospital. Each of those has a varying degree of specialists available. But invariably, except at Good Samaritan or the Banner University, at night, I drop back to being either me or a hospitalist, plus or minus other ER docs.
What was it like for you that first month of being outside of residency?
It's kind of interesting. So my first shift, they put me with one of the older guys who'd been there for a long time, and he was supposed to show me how to use the computer, and he sat with me like on my whole first shift and was talking to me about, you know, how do you put in this order, and this dude just kept looking over my shoulder being like, oh, that's what you want to order? You want to get that CT? You think that's a good idea, huh? No, that's cool, man. Do whatever you want to do. That's fine. And it, like the first half of the shift, I kept thinking, all right, well, I mean, it's this guy's license. You know, if I want, wait a minute, it's not this guy's license. Since it's my license, I'm on my own. This is me making these decisions. And, you know, for forget about what you think I ought to do. I'm just going to do what feels right. So I think a lot of that first month was, I mean, for me, it was terror. I didn't sleep really for the first month. I would wake up in a cold sweat before shifts and after shifts equally, either worried about what I was going to see that I didn't think I was going to be prepared for, or stressing out about a patient that, oh my gosh, should I have ordered a troponin, or should I have gotten a urine or whatever. But it took me about a month to kind of figure out that I'm well trained and learn to trust myself a little bit, and realize that medicine, I think, is a little bit different out there in the non-UMC world. I think the expectations in some ways are a lot higher for things like productivity, but they're also a lot lower, I think, in terms of what we consider to be academically right and what you're supposed to do with a certain issue. There's a lot more lax and a lot more leeway in what people do out there.
For those of you wondering what that noise is, that's not Casey or Jared or I crying. It's actually Carter, Jared's little boy. He's hanging out with us. Gonna learn how to edit the podcast so that he can free up our time a little bit.
You know, one thing that I have noticed is that I order a lot more CTs than I used to. It's a non-surgical abdomen, so I can take this abdominal pain and just ignore it and send it home. That doesn't happen very often anymore. I admit a lot more chest pains, and something that I think that I hadn't anticipated, or maybe I tried to but didn't know how to really anticipate, was that you're going to do things differently based on your practice environment. So the 4-hour troponin, I've literally never done that, not once since I graduated. You either admit them, or you do a 2-hour trope, which is already kind of frowned upon because your throughput times go down, or you just do a single trope if they're really low risk and send them home. But I had to change my entire approach to chest pain. It's now really, it's two phases instead of all the different layers we had. I either admit or single trope and home. So all these things that we don't do in residency because it's just the way we've always done it. All of a sudden you realize that there may be more to emergency medicine than just what we've always done. And everybody's coming from different places, having always done it their own way. So it ends up being a case that you kind of have to assimilate to the new practice environment that you're working in.
Do you think that there's a disconnect between academic emergency medicine that we teach you here and community emergency medicine that you practice when you get out of here?
Yes.
In what way?
So, I mean, it's not good, I don't think. I think that there's just such a different focus when you're out in the community on the other things, the productivity, the throughput, the patients per hour, the how long did they sit in your ER, that some of the things that academically are right, they don't end up working very well. The serial exams, I don't do those very often. If I can order a scan and get the answer now, as opposed to watch somebody for 3 hours and reassess their belly 4 to 5 different times, I'm just going to order the scan. So it's not right. I don't think that it's better. It's definitely not better, but it's just there's a totally different focus and a different emphasis that what makes you good at what you do is your ability to get the patient seen and to get the answers for them that they're looking for, rather than, you know, and not to say that I don't want to save the radiation and save the extra testing, because I do, and I still try to do it the best that I can, but some things have to get sacrificed.
It's fascinating. What about all the what about all the subspecialty stuff? In the last few years, we've had an explosion here of subspecialists. He does peds, I do critical care, we cram ultrasound down your throat. Does any of that trickle down into usefulness for you in private practice?
Definitely. I think definitely. You know, I found that everybody's going to do their own thing when they get out. I generally don't use the ultrasound at all, you know, out there. I mean, I'll do fast exams. I'll do, for whatever reason, ocular exams stuck, and I'll take a look at an eye for retinal detachment. And then, of course, I look at babies for heartbeats. But the thought of doing, like, a transvaginal ultrasound myself to try to save time, it's gonna ruin my time. And maybe it helps the time for the department, but then I don't have it documented with somebody else's name on it to spread the risk around a little bit, that if I think I see a heartbeat, or I think I see a gestational, or I guess a yolk sac, and it ends up being a pseudo-gestational sac, and they really had an ectopic, then I'm hung out to dry. Whereas having somebody else's name, you know, a radiologist who you know, their name on the chart, I think it's something that that I'm still thinking about a little bit more. As far as the pediatrics, critical care, those kinds of things, I think that absolutely changes what I do. Because, you know, when you get out there, you realize that at least for me, there's no pediatric ER that I work in, so I just see the kids when they come in. And they're mixed in with adults, they're mixed in with septic patients, they're mixed in with STEMIs, they're mixed in with trauma, and sometimes it's a combination of the above. So when I see those kids, if I can think back to the North Pod of what would I have done, what would Leach do, and in fact, I spent my first couple months even calling all these people a fair amount. Specifically, I remember the two-month-old fever was something that I didn't feel comfortable with. The one-month-old fever, we all know what to do. The three-plus month, you know what to do. It's all just based on what you see. But that two-month-old fever, that was something that I couldn't really remember what to do. And I called Leach twice. And I don't think there were any other pediatric. I called Dale Woolridge once or twice, too. But you know, aside from calling for help, just thinking back to what those experts were doing, that gives me a lot of perspective that I can't say I'll have it my whole career, because I'll probably forget it as time goes on and I'll just start doing what I do as opposed to what Leach did. But I also feel like right now I'm so close to that training that if a sick kid comes into the ER, I feel like I'm probably the best person in the department to take care of that kid.
You called me once in the middle of the night asking if Leach was around.
Yeah.
How close do you think we are to each other?
And just as an aside, one thing that I didn't feel prepared for, but I should have been, and I should have known it, is that I'm making the TPA decision every time a stroke comes in. And that's something I literally never once did in residency. I always called neurology, and they came down, they did it for me. But there's these things that you don't learn when you've got all these subspecialists around that one day they won't be, or they may not be, depending on your practice environment, and it's just on you. I got a little sheet. There's only one thing. I carry two things in my pocket on every shift, two references. One is Dale's pediatric drug dosing reference, and the other one is the TPA contraindications, because it was the thing that I felt the least comfortable with. And every time I see a stroke, I pull that thing out. It's this ratty piece of paper now, because it's in my white coat pocket, which, yes, I have to wear a white coat, which is ridiculous. But it comes out of my white coat pocket on every one, and I'm looking through the list of, is this person really a candidate or not? And I'm going to have to live and die by that decision, or I guess the patient is, and all my, you know, my... That's medical not, legal risk goes with it.
That's not Carter, that's me at the thought of all this. You're disgusting.
So it ends up being the case that I feel a little bit more like the general purpose doctor. You know, I feel like I'm just that guy who may or may not have somebody out there who knows a better answer, but they're not available to me. So I just make the best decision I can with what I've got. And that's where I say that the hardest part about getting out there in the beginning was learning to trust myself, learning that you may not be able to get that person, that specialist, to come give you the answer on what to do. And for what it's worth, one more piece of it is that I have, in my entire time, outside of Good Sam at the other hospitals, I've had only a couple, probably less than five times, where I've consulted somebody and they've actually seen the patient in the ER. A consult to me is a phone call, and I describe to the best, you know, the best that I can what I'm seeing, and the consultant says, here's what I'd recommend that I do or that you do, but ultimately you're the one seeing the patient, so my name's not going to be on the chart. Good luck, you know, good luck making your best decision. So it's just a different world. It was scary at first, and now I feel pretty comfortable with it, and now I feel like I've settled into just trusting that those 7 years of training that I had have made me into somebody who I should be able to trust. And I'm going to make mistakes. I know I will. The goal is just to try to avoid it or limit it as much as I can.
What kind of a doctor do you feel like you were in residency compared to how you practice now? Do you feel you're more conservative, less conservative, more liberal, less liberal?
So I think I was always pretty conservative. But I'm way more conservative now. I mean, way, way more conservative. And maybe other people go the other way. I'm just one example. I have to see what other people say. But I scan a lot more things. I admit a lot more things. I work up a lot more things than a lot of the people that I work with, and than I did when I was in residency. Which comes back to bite me, because sometimes I'm looking for things that I've only heard of a couple times, and then I find it. And then I'm like, well, crap, now what do I do with this? I looked for it. I was smart enough to know to look for it, but I'm not smart enough to manage it. So I find myself in a conundrum now that being conservative actually can sometimes work to my disadvantage, because now I'm stuck trying to find an answer of how do you manage things you've never seen before. But the one thing that, and I was just listening to a podcast, I think it might have been one of you guys' podcasts from a couple months ago, and somebody said, you're never going to learn in residency everything that you need to learn to get out there and take care of every patient you're ever going to see. So there's still things... It's not often, I guess, anymore, but probably once a week I'll see something I've never seen before. And I think, I don't have an attending to ask. I don't have, you know, I don't really even know who to call about this because I don't even know which specialty would address it. Recently, I had my first fistula bleed on a dialysis patient, and literally, I took the pressure, the pressure dressing, which was really just me squeezing as hard as I could, and as soon as I took any pressure off, it literally squirted onto the ceilings. It was on the walls. It was on my face. I didn't have a face mask on. It was literally everywhere, and I'd never seen that before. I'd never seen it. I heard about it, and I know, you know, there's ideas of where you can put these stitches and what you can do, and thank God I happened to be at a hospital where I had a vascular surgeon who was able to come in, and I had one of the nurses just stand there with their hand on it, squeezing as hard as they could until they went to the operating room. But what if I were in Payson? I wouldn't have had a vascular surgeon, period, to call. You know, and there's still things that I think, thank God I wasn't in Payson when that happened, because I don't know what I would have done. I'd have figured it out. One thing I've learned is that you figure it out. I would have figured it out. I don't right now, sitting here, know what I would have done and how it had gotten there. But the thing that I've learned is that in residency, we did a little bit, everybody pretended like we didn't, but we did a little bit of cherry picking, right? You picked up a chart that you felt comfortable with. You picked up a chart when you felt like you were ready for it. And in my job, that just doesn't exist. I work in a zone, a pod, that is the patients are given to me by the charge nurses who don't care whether I'm ready for a new patient. They don't care if I'm comfortable with this patient. They don't care if I know what I'm doing. So the first couple times that I had that code or that pediatric code or that weird presentation or the time when I had that fistula bleeding, I wanted so badly to let somebody else see it, but it was in my zone and it was me. And I sat there for a second thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do, but the nurses all look to me, the techs all look to me, everybody looks to me and says, all right, doc, you know, let's go fix it, or you go fix it. And I took my coat off and walked in the room. And as I was walking, there was a terror, but there was also this peace of thinking, I figured out how to deal with everything so far. I'll figure out how to deal with this. I don't yet know what I'm going to do, but I'll figure it out somehow.
I love the honesty. So going with the honesty, is there anything that you weren't prepared for in residency? Is there any procedures you didn't get enough of? Is there anything that you didn't learn enough that, you know?
Yes is the answer, and it's not what anybody wants to hear, but I'll just tell you, I haven't done enough chest tubes in my life to feel comfortable with them. I just haven't. I just have not done enough chest tubes. The ones that I did, now when I think back on it, the last time I did a chest tube, I was a junior, and since then, I would give them to the interns when I was a senior, and now I haven't had to do one yet since I've been out, but when I wake up now, there's not a whole lot of things that still bother me. The pediatric code is something that still scares me going into work. And then the really, really rare things like the perimortem C-section, those are things that truly I don't think you can ever be prepared for. But the thing that I always think about as I'm walking into work is, I hope I don't have to put in a chest tube today because I'm not sure I really know what I'm doing.
Dude, what are you doing? Don't tell them stuff like that. All right. Now, to be fair, I've heard from other graduates that they feel they got plenty of chest tubes in residency, so maybe Casey gave up too many as a senior. But if you feel this way about anything, you feel this way about peds airways, you feel this way about chest tubes, you feel this way about internal pacers, whatever it is, let us know. Let somebody that you trust, look up to, admire in residency know, and we'll try to figure out how to do it. We'll try to make sure that you leave residency feeling confident as best as you can. Now, can I give everybody a third degree heart block that they can place a internal pacer on? No, probably not. Can I promise all of you that you'll get to do a thoracotomy? No. But some of these things, you just need to know the steps. And you can refer to Dr. Rosen's opinion of procedural competency during last month's episode to get an idea from the many years out perspective.
But to take that aside and look at everything else, I think that the thing that I feel the most comfortable with, which is something that I didn't realize other people were so uncomfortable with, and that's airways. So airways are something that we do all the time. We've got SACLs to teach us how to use all the different devices. We have good staff that'll let you do whatever you want. Jared's laughing, but he let me do a digital intubation just using my fingers to feel the dude's glottis and cram a tube in there. But that's something that I find now that I'm out, people who've done this for 20, 30 years, they still get nervous every time they intubate. And I just don't. I just don't at all. I feel like I've got my 1 through 5, you know, steps of what I'm going to do. And if this fails, here's the next step and the step after that. And I just feel very comfortable with that. So, and the other thing too, the last piece of that is, and maybe it fits under the airway thing, or maybe airway fits under this, but critical care, I feel like I've got critical care. I mean, the expectation for critical care from the average ER doc out in the community is very different than the expectation for critical care here at UMC. Here, we've got the patient for 6 hours. You can't get them up to the unit because the attendings up there are busy doing other things and they don't want to take new patients. I'm kidding, Jared. But really, it does take 6 hours. You know, it takes hours to get the patients upstairs. So you're putting in your lines, your A lines, your pressors, you're titrating everything, you're pulling your SVO2s. Whereas people out there in the community may not have done that in a really long time, and they oftentimes don't know what I'm talking about when I'm doing it. And that doesn't mean that I'm good. It's just that I'm just closer to my training, and we had really good critical care training. But when the really sick patient comes in, I feel like that's when I come alive, and I feel like that's when my training kicks in, and I feel like, once again, I feel like of the docs who are on with me, I feel like I'm the best prepared to deal with it because I know this stuff. I remember it. I just came out of my training. And the interesting thing would be for you guys to come back and ask me 10 years from now, how do I feel?
I was just going to say, we're going to come back and play this for you in 3 years and see how you feel. So,
I'll lose it.
So one last question. Is there any upside to being out of residency? Sounds like you're terrified every day that you go into work. Your partners are, you know, just looking over your shoulder for everything you do. Is there any good part about being out of residency? The raise?
You know, it's funny, that raise. Everybody wants to know about that raise. I tell you, that raise goes really quickly. It goes to things. All of a sudden, those student loans, that mortgage, the things that you didn't do when you were in residency, all of a sudden, those things come out. And I can tell you that I still have a degree of living paycheck to paycheck. Now, I'm in a group where I don't get paid a whole lot my first year, so maybe that'll change with time. But graduation is not the I've made it, I'm halfway to retirement that I think we sometimes get the idea that it is. But it's good. Just one more thing. I work more hours now than I did as a resident. I work more shifts in a month than I did as a resident, and I see way more patients in a shift than I ever did as a resident. So from that perspective, when I leave a shift, I feel like, damn, I miss residency.
To be fair, you're a chief.
That's true. Yeah. I work 16 shifts a month.
Thanks, Casey. Enjoying your day, everything's going your way, and along comes Debbie Downer. Always there to tell you about a new disease, a car accident, or killer bees. New banger to spare you, Debbie, please, but you can't stop Debbie Downer. With all seriousness, I'd like to thank Casey for talking to us this month. In reality, Casey's right that first year out can be freaky. But I hope you can glean from this segment that you will leave well-trained enough to know what you need to do when the time comes. Even though it may keep you up the first few nights, even though it may freak you out when you run across that thing that you've only heard of but never actually seen, you know what to do. When it comes down to it, even Casey said, I know I could figure out what to do. But when you don't know off the top of your head, it can be a little bit freaky. But we'll have Casey back in a year or two, play this for him again, and we'll see if he still feels that way.
Well, you can tell everybody. Yeah, you can tell everybody. Go ahead and tell everybody. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man. Yes, I am, yes, I am, yes, I am.
To piggyback off of something that Casey said, it's very easy for us to become dependent on our consultants working in a tertiary care center like we do. You may have thought to yourself, or maybe had an attending say to you, I think I know what to do. I might even be able to deal with this myself, but let's just call the consult to be sure. Now, we often have this situation where somebody comes in to see their biliary duct gastroenterologist or their pediatric retinal specialist who only operates on the left eye. And yes, those people need to be called. But many of you will be in an area where you can't expect the surgeon to be in-house to press on every belly or have the neurologist decide on TPA for your strokes. So considering this, I asked Dr. Rosen, how do we avoid becoming consultant dependent in residency?
As a resident, you should sit down and think about, why do you need a consultant? Okay. Sometimes you need a consultant because it's the Byzantine political complexity of the institution you work in. All hand cases have to be seen by the hand service. But you know as well as I do that all hand cases don't have to be seen, certainly don't need to be seen immediately, and that you have to make up your own mind what it is you need from the consultant. When do you need a consultant to teach you how to diagnose a patient? Answer to that should be almost never. Probably more in neurology than almost any other condition, but even there, you should be able to diagnose 99% of your patients. So why do you need a consultant? Is it for diagnosis? No. Is it for management? Possibly, because there are complex managements that you can't do in the emergency department. If it's for admission, if it's for a technical procedure, if it's for a complex follow-up, clearly that's why you need a consultant. But do you need the consultant to see the patient? And that's something else that you want to think about. So disposition is a reason for a consultant, but not usually a need to have one immediately in the department. And then the third need is because the patient has an acute problem that needs acute solution, and you can't give the solution, and the consultant does. And you ought to think about each one of your patients in terms of, do they possess such a problem? Now, here I'm talking more about orthopedics and possibly general surgery than any other specialty. Does an orthopedist need to see this fracture, and if so, why? Okay. Or can I splint it and send it to him? Does a general surgeon need to see this patient? And if the answer is yes, it's because you in your mind have decided the patient needs an acute operation. And if that's the case, then you got to fight for that consultant to come and come quickly. But if you reserve your consultations for where they're really necessary, then you'll find that you're not become dependent on them, and that the people who are really kind of bad doctors and are kind of lazy. Now, psychiatry, why do you need a psychiatrist to tell you whether or not a patient's crazy? There is no psychiatric diagnosis that you need a psychiatrist for. What you need a psychiatrist for is disposition. And you know that before you ever call him. So make up your own mind. Is this suicidal patient dangerous to himself or herself? If she is, and I use that pronoun advisedly since it represents 80% of the suicide patients you see, then you got to fight for that psychiatrist to come. If she is not, then why worry about it? If you think the patient's homicidal, then it doesn't matter what the psychiatrist says, they're coming in, and you've got to insist upon it. So you got to learn as you work up your patients why you would need a consultant, when you would need it in terms of their seeing the patient. And if you start thinking of every case that you see in those terms, what is the acute problem that needs acute solution? What is the problem I'm missing that is dangerous for the patient? And when do I need help to manage this problem? You will not become consultant dependent. Like a dynamic, just be cutting, just talking loud. Don't say nothing. Don't say nothing.
Don't say nothing. You can't. Hi again, everybody. It's Brian here for the June AZM cast. We've got three topics we're going to go through today. Traumatic brain injury, number one. Number two, Casey Slalom at the bat with his comments. And number three, Rosen's finale. So the first topic was a lecture by Dr. Joseph about traumatic brain injury. And just to, I want to make sure people are clear on, there's two kind of definitions I see with traumatic brain injury being used both in the literature and talked about in discussions. The traumatic brain injury Dr. Joseph's talking about is where big trauma to head and there's a concern about bleeding and whether the patient needs to go to surgery. The other kind of traumatic brain injury is damage to the brain, maybe a repeated damage, multiple concussions, maybe a blast injury, some kind of assaults in the past, that's leading to a cognitive change, headaches, maybe chronic headaches, fatigue, sleep changes, behavioral changes, mental status changes. And those are more of a chronic cognitive, but not necessarily looking for blood or surgery. Now, they may be one and the same initially, but then they change,
right? Some become more progressive, and some you just, oh, I bonked my head, no blood, we're done. No long-term issues. So just know there's two kinds of traumatic brain injury. We're going to be talking really about the someone just smacked their skull pretty hard. So let's focus on that. So in my approach to these head trauma patients, I look for four things initially. I look their GCS, a neuro exam, whether on anticoagulations and their mechanism. And if they have a GCS of 15, a normal neurologic exam, no anticoagulation use, and a mechanism that's not too worrisome, they didn't do a head dive off 20 feet, then I'm probably not going to CT these people. They're at a very low risk for bleeding, and most of these people will be diagnosed with a concussion sent home. Now, if one of those changes, then that increases my likelihood for doing a CT scan. So if the same patient came in and they're on anticoagulation and their mechanism wasn't, well, I was walking down my hallway and I turned and a cabinet door hit me in the head, that's probably a low mechanism. I may not scan them. But if they said, oh, I fell down in my same hallway, that's mechanism enough that I would scan them. Same thing is if they have a non-normal neurologic exam, probably going to get a scan. A low GCS or high mechanism, they're all going to get scanned. And why are we scanning these people? And Dr. Joseph kind of hit on this. You're really looking for something that you're going to call neurosurgery because you want them to cut on this. So the kind of three areas I'm looking for are epidurals, really, which is just a mechanism bleed, right? Doesn't depend on anticoagulation. The other ones are going to be subdural hematomas or subarachnoid hemorrhages, and these are at increased risk from people on anticoagulation. And subarachnoids, remember, those are the number one cause of a subarachnoid hemorrhage is trauma. So you can have traumatic subarachnoids can be worsened by their anticoagulation. And the third type is a intraparenchymal bleed, and these are usually the less concerning, but can be if they're large or expanding, or with, I put the intraparenchymal is the cerebellar bleeds. Because cerebellar bleeds, even if there's a small blood, it's usually not, they'll require surgical evaluation, but it may not have the same rush to the OR that a subdural or large subarachnoid or epidural may have. If I took my brain and cut it open, something bad's going to happen. I mean, that's just not a normal process for your brain to be opened up. It's not a coconut with milk inside. It's just little really small neurons that are going to get screwed up. So we don't want neurosurgery to be involved because their job is to cut. So ideally, these patients will be managed without a surgical intervention, but you may need neurosurgery's consultation. So that's why we are looking in these patients to do a CT scan to see if we need to have blood, no blood, and does that blood require neurosurgery to come see them. Right? The bigger the blood, the more problems, certain types of bleeds definitely need surgery. Dr. Joseph covered all this. So what should we be doing? Well, I think we should read our own CT scans. And there are four things that I comment on when I read a traumatic head CT. And I'll put reads in my note, or I'll put them on the radiology PAC system or whatever computer system, just to give feedback to the radiologist so they know what I saw. And the four big things I comment on is, number one, midline shift. This is not a hard thing to look at, right? You can take the ruler and compare one side to the other. Does the line go straight through the skull? That white line, those the mid-sagittal, or is it going off to one side or the other? So midline shift. Number two, mass effect. Is that blood pushing other areas? Is it compressing a ventricle? Is it pushing and changing the gray-white differentiation in the cortex? Those are things you can comment on. Skull fracture. Switch it to bone windows. Look for skull fractures, not sutures, skull fractures. If there's a skull fracture, right, higher mechanism of injury, more likely for a bleed. And then the fourth thing I'll comment on is the bleed. If I see a bleed, I'll comment on it. So my CT read may look like No midline shift, no mass effect, no skull fracture, no evidence of epidural or subdural hematoma, no evidence of subarachnoid hemorrhage. Simple as that. Or I'll comment if there's something positive. So you can make those CT identifications. Dr. Joseph also talked about the clotting disruptor medications that we like to prescribe for patients to help them out with other problems. I think they are totally on that Plavix is the devil, and Aaron agrees, and Bobby Boucher's mom agrees. That foosball and the Plavix are the devil. You are not playing with that drug.
Not exactly what I call constructive penalty, is it?
I think Plavix just causes people to bleed, and I really don't think it's an ER medication. If you are prescribing Plavix, you have some gonads that are giant and producing lots of hormones. I don't think there's a reason we should be giving it. Very rarely could you find a reason that I would give Plavix, even in acute coronary syndrome. That's a decision the cardiologist can make. There is no data to show it needs to go early within the first hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. It's a decision that can be done at cath with the same results. So Plavix, bad. I think the second worst medication I worry about is the new anticoagulants that people are on for their AFib stroke prevention protocols. And the reason is the reversal patterns for these is not good. Warfarin's number three on my list. It causes more bleeding and causes problems, but we have a better way to reverse it. So that's why it goes to number three. And aspirin, I'm just not as worried about. Yes, it affects platelets, but much less bleeding or worsening bleeding from an injury than the other ones. So that's mine. I know Dr. Joseph talked about this and put Plavix and aspirin in the same box, and I disagree. I think Plavix is much worse than aspirin, even a full dose aspirin. I'd rather have someone on that than on Plavix. Another topic they were covering in his lecture and Aaron was commenting on was about repeat scanning. I think there's very few roles for repeat scanning and where it's useful. So I agree we shouldn't be ordering repeated head CTs for these trauma patients. There is evidence out there that talks about when does someone on some of these anticoagulants with a head trauma have a bleed. So say their first CT is normal. And when does their bleed occur? Well, it can be anywhere from a couple hours to 7 to 10 days later. You're not going to hold that person for 7 to 10 days in your emergency room or whatnot. So if you have someone on anticoagulation, this is another population you can deal with. So you have a patient presentation you can deal with. So if you have someone on has a head trauma, they're on anticoagulation, initial CT looks good, they look good, they can go home. You can give them precautions and reasons to return. You don't need to hold them and do a 4 to 6 hour CT scan before you discharge them. Now, I know some people do that, but the evidence will show that you can do that, but you don't know if they're going to have a bleed one day later. So that repeat CT scan isn't helping you. If they're changing their mental status, changing their neurologic exam, or having other concerning signs of a bleed, they will come back. Just discharge them with someone they know. If you have, you know, it's a homeless person and you're worried, well, they probably should be on Coumadin or Plavix if they're homeless anyway. But, you know, if you're worried, sure, keep them. I'm not saying no, but most of these people, you can do a single scan and go home. So when do I order a repeat CT scan? The most common time I would do it would be CT scan shows blood in the brain. Okay, I should probably get this guy to ICU. Whether it's a small subdural, maybe it's a small subarachnoid, small interparenchymal, but they look good. They're acting normal. They said, yeah, my head hurts, but I feel okay, doc. Their neurologic exam looks good. But my ICU is full. And neurosurgery doesn't really want to see them right away. They're not impressed by the CT scan. And yes, some neurosurgeons do look at CT scans without coming to the emergency room. I know, they can do it. But I use it as a downgradable tool. So if I get a bleed and my ICU is full, I don't have a place to put them, maybe I'll do that CT scan 6 hours, show there's no change. I've observed him for 6 hours. Now I can admit him to a floor bed instead of an ICU bed. So that's probably the most common time I will use it. Dr. Joseph and Aaron were also commenting a little bit on platelets, and if someone's on Plavix or aspirin, has a head bleed, do you give them platelets? I would be wary about making a decision that you're going to give someone platelets for this, or treating a number, whether it's 25, 50, 100, 200. There's not a lot of good evidence for any of this. I think as long as you work with your colleagues, and I don't think it's bad to give it, but in terms of all these other things that we see with blood, we are lessening, and the data is starting to show that less blood products, people probably do better. So if they've taken the drug's still in their system, unless it's totally used up, the likelihood of it still inhibiting some platelets is pretty good. Now, I understand the argument, oh, I want to overwhelm that drug with more useful platelets than block platelets, and that's possible, but just be wary about those suggestions. I don't know if there's great evidence for it, and I wouldn't by myself start just dumping platelets into people and say, I'm going to fix your head bleed just with platelets. All right, that was a good lecture, good concepts. I think a lot of these are fluid topics, and I think we are starting to see more downgradable patients that can go to a floor with a head bleed, don't have to have neurosurgery involved. There's also patients we may eventually say, oh, they've got a little head bleed. It's tiny interparenchymal. They look great. The mechanism is small. Maybe we'll send them home in the future. I know people aren't ready for that, but these are the same people who we diagnosed with their bell getting rung in the past, and we didn't have fancy CT scanners, nor could we CT everyone, and they did fine. So I think this will be an evolving topic. Just keep your eyes open and be open to changes in your practice and different places where you work. Next topic, Casey Salm had some good advice about first year out. And Aaron's right. I mean, I was doing bloodletting my first year out, which is a long time ago. I mean, it's probably like a year ago, I think I graduated. But the bloodletting still works. I still use it. I think it's really effective. If that doesn't work, I give the patients Haldol. If that doesn't work, I give them morphine. If that doesn't work, they're going to get Benadryl, probably some magnesium. And if it all else fails, my last drug I use is epinephrine. I only have 5 drugs I use, and it cures 95% of my patients. So leeches, good. Aaron leeches, better. So Casey talked about the fear going into the first shift. I completely agree. You are going to be afraid going into your first shift, and that fear is good. That means you care. That means you want to do the right thing for patients. So embrace that fear. That's what you want to have. I had that. I was reciting RSI drugs in my head, driving to work my first few shifts, probably for a month or two. I was reciting ACLS codes. Normal response. Totally normal. I know Casey was talking about his single troponin and discharging people. I would be very wary of doing that. I think most people need a single troponin if they have had symptoms for 8 or 12 hours continuously and you want to do a single troponin, I think you're in good stead. But someone has 2 hours of symptoms, you should be getting 2 troponins if you're worried about acute coronary syndrome. And to order screening troponins, I think you open a big can of worms if you start willy-nilly ordering tests for screening. I mean, that's like a screening D-dimer, a screening troponin. We're going to get high sensitivity troponins coming out, and then you're going to be getting tons of false positives because you're screening. Be careful. Order the tests that you think are appropriate for that patient. Don't screen everybody for everything. Casey also talked about getting CT scans and not doing serial exams. I think you can do both. I think CT scans are fine, and in the community, we'll do CT scans and just get the answer. And I know radiation's bad, but sometimes time is better. I don't know. But in terms of my serial exams, even if I'm not doing a CT scan, I will document a 1 hour or 2 hour serial exam. No, I'm not going to keep them 6 hours for their abdominal pain. But if I do a couple exams, maybe initially, maybe at the 1 hour to see how they're feeling, give them some of their test results, and maybe at 2 hours, and then done. Document those three. You give them precautions. You tell them to come back in 12 to 24 hours. I think that's all reasonable. So you can do serial exams. It may just not be the 4 to 6 hour abdominal pain serial exam. Just shorten the duration. Casey also talked about his ultrasound use and where he used it, why he did. And, you know, ultrasounds, I love ultrasound. I think it's variable for everybody. And some people feel comfortable with certain exams and they incorporate them into their practice. I think you want to incorporate whatever you feel comfortable with. But it's okay to make decisions based on your ultrasound. And sometimes if you don't see it, you don't see it and you just, you know, you call for help. That's okay too. The thing is, when you learn ultrasound and when you practice it and apply it, you've got to just make a decision with it. If you ultrasound the gallbladder and you think you see gallstones, but you're not sure, order the confirmatory test. Order a formal ultrasound. And if you had the same images that the ultrasonographer had, you're going to gain confidence and you're going to use your ultrasound skills more. So that's something definitely to practice during residency, or if you're picking up a new ultrasound technique further on in your career. I would argue that ultrasound can be time-saving if you do it, but can also be time-consuming if you do it. So you have to know your department. One place I worked, I was able to get an ultrasound back within 20 minutes of me ordering it. I mean, I could not do the ultrasounds that fast, and it was more effective for me to go see other patients than do those ultrasounds. But when you're going to go see that abdominal pain patient and you bring the ultrasound in the room, and while you're talking to them, you're ultrasounding the gallbladder and you're telling them their gallbladder looks good while you're doing your review of systems and getting their history, you can do some synergistic examining and ultrasounding at the same time, and that is time savings. Casey also talked about having to make a decision on TPA. And I think the decision you always should make by yourself is no, you're never going to give it, but that's a whole other discussion. The reasons to give it for stroke, I think, yes, you should be the one making it. So no, if you want to make it and give someone TPA for stroke, that's a decision that we do, right? We're the big boys and girls. We make decisions. I will argue that emergency physicians are the best physicians in the hospital. We know what needs to be done, who needs to do it, how they need to do it. We're calm under pressure. We can handle almost every situation. So be confident. You're the one that makes decisions. I don't need an ear, nose, and throat doctor to tell me what to do. I need an ear, nose, and throat doctor like Peter talked about to take out someone's tonsils because I can't do that. So use your consultants for things that you can't do. He also talked about how much he was learning. We're all lifelong learners. So just continuously be skeptical, learn, change your practice, change it again. It's okay. There's multiple things. I used to not give Flomax to anyone for kidney stones. Then I started to give it. Then I stopped giving it again. And now I see lots of people giving it. So you'll change your practice. And that's okay. That's a good practitioner. Someone who keeps their practice the same day after day, year after year, that's not good. That's going to hurt somebody. And Casey was also talking about just the stress and pressure out there. And I think for all of us, when we're in these stressful situations, just slow the mechanism of your brain down, right? There are very few conditions in emergency medicine that are going to kill someone in a couple seconds. Take your time, breathe, gather data points, gather information from the patient, get through that first minute. Again, then get through 2 minutes. Then it'll be 5 minutes. Eventually, you'll be at a half hour, 2 hours, 4 hours. You'll be able to figure that patient out. I know some of you have seen me with respiratory distresses, and I'll tell you, you can't intubate someone for 5 minutes. And you're sitting and looking, what are you doing? And I said, I want you to think, gather information, get your neurologic exam, get your drugs ready, prep everything, talk to the patient, find out other things from paramedics. There's very few conditions, unless someone's apneic, that they need a tube immediately within 0 seconds of them entering the room. 5 minutes, you've given them time to pre-oxygenate. You've got your nurses on board. Everyone's got the drugs ready. It's a reasonable period of time. But that just helps you slow your thoughts and you're not racing. When you race, you get out of control. So don't be out of control. Slow the thoughts. You can handle these situations. You can do it. And the last thing Peter was talking about was consultants. So my analogy I like to use for consultants and my relationship is I see emergency physicians as the handyman, right? They're the general contractor. They get called in. They think through things. They look at patients. They do stuff. And consultants are tools in my handyman's toolbox. So yes, your consultants are tools. Don't tell them that. But they're tools, right? If I need someone to take out an appendix, I need my hammer appendectomy removal tool. You know, if I need someone to admit a patient, I need my internal medicine screwdriver, admit the patient to the floor tool. They're your tools. You need to tell your consultants what you want them to do, right? You're in control of the patient. You know what needs to happen for them, but sometimes you just can't do it. And there's occasionally, you know, your tools are the instruction booklet because you just don't know what's going on and you're calling for help. But you shouldn't call for help like, well, their chest pain, I don't know what's causing their chest pain. What do you think? You should have some ideas. Hey, I've looked at their chest pain. I don't think there's a pericardial effusion. I don't think this is pericarditis. I don't think this is a PE. I'm concerned that they may have some diastolic dysfunction, but maybe it's a myocarditis that's causing it. I'm not sure. Right? That's a reasonable conversation and an intellectual conversation to have instead of saying, I just don't know. Don't be a don't know, right? Be the handyman. Use your tools and you'll do well. All right, thank you so much. I'm going to go think about my first shift again and probably weep in the corner with a beverage. So, see you guys in July. Have a great day.
Walk away, it's time to say goodbye. 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 Walk away, it's time to say goodbye.